Hello and welcome. You're listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. Hello and welcome to episode 193 of Writers Aloud. In this episode, the poet Judy Brown talks with Julia Kopus about career change, writers' residencies, and how certain places can live on in the mind long after they've been left.
The poet Judy Brown studied English at Cambridge and then Newcastle universities, but went on to pursue a career in law. For a number of years, she worked as a lawyer in London and in Hong Kong, where she lived during the early 90s, and where she took a pause from working on the poems she had written all her life. After moving back to England, Judy made the decision to return to her passion for words and commit to writing full-time, and since then she has published 2 pamphlets and 2 full-length collections, and also held writers' residencies at the Wordsworth Trust in Grasmere and Gladstone's Library in Wales, and been awarded a Hawthornden Fellowship. Her first book, Loudness, was shortlisted for the Forward and Fenton Alderer Prizes for Best First Collection. Her second, Crowd Sensations, is a Poetry Book Society recommendation. Judy met with me to talk about career changes, living the life of a writer in residence, and how certain places can live on in the mind long after they've been left. Judy, lots of people dream of giving up the day job to write full time, but not many actually get round to doing it. Can you talk us through how it happened for you? And what sort of stage of your career and your life you were at, and how you went about it and so on?
Well, for many years I hadn't written at all. And in 2004 I started writing poems again for the first time after, about 12 years. I'd written when I was at school, and I'd written when I was at university, and I'd written when I was a trainee lawyer. I'd stopped writing when I went out to Hong Kong in 1992, probably because just taking in so much new foreign stuff kind of was overwhelming. And secondly, not for any determined reason, but more just I didn't really know enough to write anything that wasn't just touristy and visitorish. And after that, I just never got back to it. I think I just assumed it was a young person's thing, and that perhaps whatever it was that made me do it had stopped.
So then you did go back to writing. When we say writing, we mean writing poems. Mm. Yeah. And managed to combine that for a while with your job.
I managed to work full-time for, I think, 2 years after, and then I was really conscious that I very much would rather be writing a poem than writing a loan agreement. So I went part-time. That was about 2006. So mm-hmm. It was another 6 years, I suppose, before I actually left.
So you did it very, very gradually, but there was a point at which you decided, yeah, I'm going to leave and do this full-time.
Yes, I think I was worried about doing it for the wrong reasons. I was particularly worried that it would be easy to think, if I give it my income and I give it my house, which I also sold, that will help make me better.
It's a lot of pressure, isn't it?
But also, being a good writer is being a good writer. You could do it if you can do it. Mm. And if you can't, you can't. And I guess, you know, lots of people are brilliant writers and still hold down a job. And I think I was wanting not to assume it was too important what I did for my work. The question is, how good are your poems? If they're not good enough, they're not good enough, I guess. Mm. I felt. And I was really hesitant at trying to make them better by doing something which was completely irrelevant.
When you did decide to leave, and in fact left, what was the reaction you got from friends and family and other folk?
I think, as is often the case myself, you give advice which has its roots in your own feelings. So I suppose people who thought writers should be vocational were delighted for me and thought I should have done it years ago. It had been on my mind. Mm-hmm. People who were worried about what would happen to me thought I shouldn't have done it. My family were actually very pragmatic. They just said, well, we didn't think you should have done it, but now you've done it, so that's great.
Oh, that's sort of the ideal reaction. So they were willing to change their minds.
Well, they were great because they had no stake in it for themselves.
One of the things that occurred to me, though, is that you'd been surrounded by this noise of your career and by other people. And the writing life can be a lonely life. And in fact, there is a poem in your latest collection, Crowd Sensations, called A Preparation for Loneliness. Is there a part of you that missed or still misses the teamwork involved in working as a lawyer? Have you found other ways to compensate for that or to link up with other writers?
I guess answering it in two parts. I think it's essential, probably, but it's strange to find, whether you like going to an office or not, you do belong. You know, people say good morning to you and all that sort of stuff. There is a belonging. I don't think until I left I realised how strange it was to become an outsider to lots of things in life. I hadn't seen it coming, but I'm not saying I took it hard, but it hit me in ways that I noticed were tiring. And like particularly after 6 months after I left work, I was luckily offered a residency for a year at the Wordsworth Trust, and I think I was really conscious there that I no longer belonged anywhere. But that was very creatively productive. In terms of what to build instead, building a network with other writers is in many ways a much richer and more complex job and more like a life's work than having a
kind of ready-made
community, a sort of chatty office community. It's different. It goes a bit deeper, so it takes time to do. But those writers who I'm close to are a real lifeline to me. I mean, I'll travel halfway across England to spend a day talking to a friend, and that the ideas that come out in that day from talking to another poet, you know, that will keep me going for 6 months, and we might write further from what we've discussed. So that's one thing. I also have a fairly long-term collaboration with the poet Katrina Naomi, who's is a friend, but we have a poem conversation that's been going for 2 or 3 years.
Yeah.
Longer, probably 3 or 4 years, while I was in the Lakes, while I was in Derbyshire, while Katrina's in Penzance. So that, I think, is a constant, and having that sense of connection is really important. There are obviously other poets I have informal networks with too, and that's vital, I think. I don't know how I'd manage without it.
And I'm also thinking, listening to you, about the fellowship provided by the RLF. Certainly that's something that I feel connected to other writers through.
The RLF's been a really important thing to me, and not just the fellowship of other poets, but through the RLF I've also met novelists, biographers, all sorts of other types of writing. And that's really new to me, because I've really tended to meet other poets through my own writing, I guess. And so having this has kind of opened another door really for me. But that, of course, the RLF is helpful to writers in other ways than simply providing them with companions. So yes, it's been a really important organisation for me.
Now, you have moved around a fair bit, and setting is a source of inspiration for several of your poems, as is travel. That's also a big theme in your poems. I'm wondering if you write on site, sort of on the hoof, as you're doing this, travelling around, or are you more of the Wordsworth school, sort of looking back on things that have happened to you? Emotion recollected in tranquility?
I think probably both. I am a bit of a scribbler on trains and boats and aeroplanes and things like that, just because a lot of your time is spent on them, and what else would you do other than write or read? But that isn't to say that sometimes images don't return. I think images are both picked up at the time but also come back. I mean, I hadn't written anything about being in Hong Kong until quite a long way into my writing career, so that was strange that suddenly came back at me in a sort of whoosh one weekend, and I found myself like reading old diaries with a certain amount of alarm that hadn't been opened since they were written. So I think it's both, but probably that sense that even if you're sitting with nothing to do in a train station, I probably, because I started writing really seriously quite late on in life, that makes me sound like ages on, but after a long gap.
You're not quite in your 90s yet.
But I have an anxiety about letting go of it. So there's something about wherever I am, the idea that writing is with me is important to me. Probably perhaps more desperate to me than people who have just written all their lives and could never imagine its absence.
I'm interested that you used the word alarm when you looked back at your Hong Kong diaries, because I think strong emotions like alarm or fear or anger can be good catalysts for creative work. Was that the case, that there was a real sense of urgency in looking back at what happened in Hong Kong that propelled you into writing?
I think it was maybe, I mean, I think I always tend to find there are points of resonance across life, and it's at those points that you feel, it's a bit like dowsing, you feel something is there. So that's often what makes you know that there's something that may become a poem. it was weirder with Hong Kong because I think I had put it in the past with my legal life, I guess. And to open some diaries that hadn't been opened since they were written is very odd because you get that sort of past on the hoof. I mean, the past is so transmuted in your memory and so neutralised and distorted and cartoonised and smoothed over. And to find words that you had written at the time, which were, of course, you know, nonsensical and hard to read, and was quite interesting.
Of the poems in which setting itself takes centre stage, the street of the dried seafood shops, Shing Wan, Hong Kong, is an absolute favourite of mine. And I'm just going to read out a few lines to give listeners a flavour of that particular poem. So it's written in couplets, and the speaker is walking down this famous, it's quite a famous street, isn't it, in Hong Kong. This long street of shops whose wares of dried seafood and other types of food are on display out the front. And I think you communicate the confusion and the hecticness of that experience brilliantly. I must admit, I had to look up pemmican in the second line here in this extract, and I learned it was a concentrated mixture of fat and protein used as a nutritious food. Is that right?
I think so, yes.
And the speaker of the poem says, I stumble past the fronds of calamari, frozen mid-Mexican wave. I, cockled sheets of pemmican, trams spark and rattle under their tense electrics, dusting the piled kilos of brown mussels, complex as rucksacks with their laces and straps. What I admire here is the piling up of images and that frenetic, chaotic feel of it all, which you communicate partly visually. So we've got those calamari frozen mid-Mexican wave and the dust from the trams falling onto a stack of mussels, but also very strikingly by sound. So we have calamari, Mexican, cockled pemmican, spark, electrics, kilos, complex, rucksacks, all those K's. It's like the clacking of shells or indeed the sound that dry seafood would make. How conscious are you of the technical side of things while you're actually writing, especially with regard to sound? I mean, are you purposely hunting out words with certain sounds as you write, or does that sort of thing happen for you on a more subconscious level?
I don't think I am hunting them out consciously. I have a slight feeling of concern sometimes that sort of writing is definitely how I'm trying to get down how I experience things. And then I worry that people will think the perception of the world is too crowded for their taste or too crowded for how people think poems should be. But at the same time, you have to write in the way that you feel is true to your perception.
Because what you're writing there, to my ear, replicates perfectly your perception at that time. The perception for you of being in this particular place was very crowded and frenetic. Your style of writing fits the bill perfectly there.
That's really nice to hear, because I think, I mean, I don't even know how much of this was conscious, but whatever was the reason about being in Hong Kong that stopped me writing, I think some of it was I had, what could I possibly say that would be valuable? You know, what can you say about a place that you don't understand? And that, in a way, that poem was one of the second group of poems I wrote much later when I did write about Hong Kong again. And there is that, in a way, I suppose what it's enacting is the fact that you can't understand, and there's a kind of stupidity of not understanding and almost a lack of right to go on about it. But
that in itself is a very interesting idea to capture, I think. I think you don't need to understand something perfectly in order to win the right to write about it, because the very fact that you're recreating the lack of understanding in the poem is interesting in itself.
I suppose that's right, because there's a kind of crudity in that puzzlement that I'm half ashamed with, but obviously that poem does enact, I suppose. I mean, that's what it does.
I think it's something that lots of people can relate to.
That's nice to hear.
Which is what you want your poems to do in an ideal world. Now, objects quite often undergo some sort of metamorphosis in your poems. We've talked about the dried mussels like rucksacks, which is very unexpected and feels very right. In another poem, Room 204, Double for Single Use, the shapes and the pink-on-pink colours of the slightly tacky interior morph into mouths and tongues. And here are a few other examples I've picked out from your poems, different poems. The back of a boy's skull becomes pieces of jigsaw. A dehumidifier has plastic gills. Nuggets of coal are full of muscle. And cancer cells are flotsam coiling in the lymph's afternoon tide. Carol Ruman said something interesting about your writing. She said, magic realism is by no means the only mode in which Judy Brown writes. She works from tangible facts and detail, but is not dependent on the bizarre. A poet who instinctively sees the possibilities of defamiliarization wherever she casts her penetrating, colour-loving eye. I love that colour-loving eye. It's that word defamiliarization, though, that sums up, for me, a lot of what you as a writer are about, or seem to be about. How important is that to you, to draw out the strangeness in ordinary things?
I don't think I want them to be strange for the sake of it, but I think I'm trying to convey what the world seems like to me, the kind of meaning that is coiled inside it, which is very like that, because I think I do negotiate my way through the world by likenesses, often visual likenesses. It's the mechanism I use to sort stuff in my head. So I think you make some choices in your poems, and for me that choice is to try and make my world the one that sits in those words, I guess. You know, it's not I know people sometimes will talk about images being merely decorative, but to me it's not that way. It's the images I use to think with.
You really do see the world in those terms.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yes, it reminds me of something Salima Hill said to me once. Somebody had talked about her off-the-wall imagery, but very much like you've just said, she said, well, no, that is actually how I see things, how I believe them to be. That's how it occurs to me. I'm not searching around for the oddest image I can think of.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a similar thing, I think, to what you're saying.
Yeah, I guess if defamiliarization's an effect, that's great. But if it's a tactic, that's not so easy for me. That's not what I'm doing.
But you haven't set out with the intention of picking images just for the purpose of doing that.
No, because the likenesses you see are so much part of how your own brain works, aren't they? That, you know, they're part of your brain's history and the way it makes sense of things. And,
yes.
And so, yeah, I think it's seeing something through somebody else's eyes is strange enough, isn't
yes.
it?
And sometimes reading somebody else's perceptions of their surroundings, you come across an image that feels very weird to you and actually is quite normal to them, you find out.
Yeah, it's like sometimes you hear somebody say something on the bus, which is just a totally honest statement of the thought they have about their lives. And in a way, sometimes it's the authenticity that strikes you, that it's, you suddenly think, I've never heard anyone say that before.
Yeah.
Not because they're saying it to be original, but because they're speaking openly, I guess.
Yeah.
And if you can find a kind of openness that is both true, but maybe has that strangeness.
Yeah. I suppose this ties in a sense, with the residencies that you've held, which you've described as both exciting and familiar. Familiar in the case of Dove Cottage in Grasmere, because I believe you went to school not far from Grasmere, is that right?
Yeah, I went to the Lake School when I was a teenager.
Can you tell us a bit about those residencies and how or whether they fed into your writing or even shaped it, perhaps?
I think in quite different ways. In Gladstone's library, I took a journey through books, really, I think. That's very much how I sort of perceive it. In Grasmere, it was different because I'm definitely a city person, and I think the drive to write my poems I'm not a nature poet, and the drive to write them doesn't come from scenery. If I see something really beautiful, I'm much more likely to draw it or attempt to draw it.
Mm.
But even though I don't think I was really driven to write by the scenery of Grasmere, it was incredibly moving to me, that scenery, partly because it was familiar. Certainly going up past Windermere, that was what I saw every day on the way to school when I was, you know, when I was 15 to when I was 18. So it was deeply familiar, but also I was living in it in a way that was completely strange, having walked out of the rest of my life almost completely. But I think, in a way, Grasmere and the lakes were familiar to me because we'd driven past Windermere on the way to school. So those mountains were just a backdrop to the banal things in my life, like doing my O-levels and stuff. On the other hand, they were incredibly moving, you know, and it's an incredibly beautiful place. It's just beyond belief. But I don't think I was going to be there and write poems about the loveliness of the lake and so on. And when I was particularly moved by things like that, I think I'd try and get out a sketchbook and do some sort of cack-handed attempts at drawing it. What I do think, though, was that some of the visual imagery from the things I saw and drew and looked at really carefully when I was walking, often around, you know, around the cottage where I lived, and often quite locally, but things seemed very intense to me because I was concentrating so hard. And those have become a sort of bank of images that I'd often draw on in other contexts. I think probably, if anything, the disappearance of the rest of my life, my writing was more, came more out of that. But nevertheless, those images are really strong, and I think I'm still using them. I think my eyes and my brain are still really full of the things I saw in Grasmere, as well as a number of...
So you've stored them up for later use, and they're coming out now. You've tantalisingly mentioned a couple of times about drawing and about just how closely you were looking at things while you were in Grasmere. How does the drawing connect with your poetry?
It's not something I'm particularly good at, but it's something I do quite a lot. And I often do it as a release from poetry because it's one of the few things that I do that you think you're bypassing the words in your mind almost completely. And that's actually a relief, I think, sometimes. Not,
but it's still a way of connecting with your environment, with the same things. I mean, I'm thinking I play a musical instrument, and that's a way of getting away from words, but I'm not responding to my environment. I'm just getting in the flow. But there's something different about drawing.
In some ways, though, in drawing and writing, you are exploring your own preoccupations. Another thing I started writing, I wrote several poems when I was at the Lakes about various substances, particularly substances that were characteristic of the Lake District, coal particularly, but there are others that I'm still sort of playing with. At the Gerwood Centre, I attended a course that all the trainees at the Wordsworth Trust went on about paper, and I found that really fascinating, partly because it's one of the materials for drawing, and I'm always interested in the physical manifestation of materials for things which often have an abstract component. So that is something I'm still playing around with and still reading about. So there were a lot of pieces of information too, and also I read quite a bit of Coleridge's notebooks, and the images from Coleridge's notebooks are kind of haunting me, even though possibly nobody else would recognise them when they come out in things I'm writing, but some of the things I read there feel like things that I've experienced myself.
It sounds like the experience you had there, particularly in Grasmere, is rather present with you in a way that some of it was slightly absent while you were actually there. Is there any truth in that?
Oh, that's interesting. That's so interesting. Because I guess you do try, or you want, I suppose, an intense, something which happens to you which is intense is a gift to you as a poet in some ways. But the way that you experience it at the time it's happening, the way you experience it just after it's happened or 10 years later, all of those things are different. And you probably draw different threads at those different times. But the times that I've had in my life, which are quite intense because of all sorts of reasons, you know, whether for emotional reasons or simply because the visual intensity was so powerful, as with Hong Kong, you know, it is as if you're still there sometimes. Some mornings, places that have meant a great deal to you, and both of those places have been my home. For short times, you know, you wake up as if you were still there, or you dream that you're still there. And I do think perhaps, I know it might be pushing it a bit, but I think you tend to use past landscapes and stuff a little bit like that, that they operate both in reality, but they are places you wander around in your head.
Yes. Now, there's a poem in your latest collection called This Is Not a Garden, a title that seems to be along the lines of Magritte's famous painting of a pipe, which includes the words Ceci n'est pas une pipe. Apologies to French speakers out there, which translates as this is not a pipe. And in the poem, you use the garden as an explicit metaphor for a marriage. Just incidentally, did you want to draw our attention to that particular reference, the Magritte painting? I mean, are you interested in the philosophy of representation?
I'm not uninterested in the philosophy of representation, but that wasn't a deliberate reference. I think I was partly driven by the idea of negation. Negations in poems, I think, quite interest me. But I think I was also interested by two things. One is the epigraph to that poem, which comes from a description about Japanese gardens, which says, you know, this garden cannot even be entered. The idea of things which can't be what they seem. I think also for reading, I read at that time Polly Atkin, who's another poet. She wrote a thesis on, I can't remember the exact title, but one of the things that she had written about was the musealization, which is
one of a kind of term that was new to me, of places like, you know, literary homes like Dove Cottage, and the idea of how those institutions work, how what they present to the public. That it's a was a great read. You know, I could not imagine a PhD thesis could be so interesting.
Turning those places into museums, how you choose.
But most museums which look like houses.
Yeah.
And I was really fascinated by the idea of sort of implicit permission and so on. So actually, no, I hadn't even thought about that link. I think I was tending to think about prohibition and territory to a great extent. Are you allowed in or not?
Yeah.
Because that's often how museums work. They imply that you're allowed in. And one of the nice things in lots of ways about being a resident, whether it's at the Wordsworth Trust or at Gladstone's Library, you get to see the bits that, you know, you're allowed in. That's one of the things why it's so nice to have a residency, because you see them.
Behind,
you know, you see
scenes.
People ironing the skirts or whatever. You see them when they're not dressed up in their kind of public facing faces. It's interesting.
So going back to the poem, in the poem we don't hear the word marriage until just about halfway through, although we get glimpses of a relationship before then, specifically of a couple eating out in the garden at night. I just want to draw listeners' attention at this point to the concision with which you paint your scenes. So here you're describing that al fresco evening meal, and you do it in just two lines. The iPod snicking in its dock, soft lighting making silhouettes beyond the trellis. And there we have not only the setting but the atmosphere of that occasion. And our minds start to turn. If it's quiet enough to hear the iPod snicking in its dock, why is it so quiet? What stage is this marriage at? What does the marriage mean to the speaker of the poem? Well, I think the poem itself answers these questions wonderfully. And it would be a great pleasure to hear you read it aloud, Judy. Would you do that for us?
Yeah, I'd be glad to. Thank you.
Before you read, I want to say what an absolute treat it has been to have you with us today and to enjoy a little taster of your work.
Just wanted to say thank you and thanks to the RLF and thanks for such interesting questions and thoughts, Julia.
It's been a pleasure. So here is Judy reading This Is Not a Garden.
Thanks, Julia. So this is not a garden. The epigraph is this. It's from a book called A Guide to the Gardens of Kyoto by E. Mark Treib, I think that's how you pronounce it, and Ron Herman. And the epigraph goes, "This garden, in fact, may not even be entered." This is not a yard. This is a garden. New decking slatted over a tumble of roaches. This is a yard full of potted tropical flora, the lotus swimming in its own pool. Mosquito-eating fish guarding its stem. I can't know whether this is a yard or a garden, though we ate out here last night, the iPod snicking in its dock, soft lighting making silhouettes behind the trellis. This is not a garden, this outdoor, hoseable sofa, or this bed where we never both sleep well. It is a sort of park, public in places. This marriage, where amusements are scheduled and planned. This garden, this marriage, is divided into rooms. In some, others are welcome, like yourself. This yard, this marriage, this bed, should be like a garden. So many topics victim to the secateurs. It should pass like a wave through the seasons, appearing to be young, or else gnarled, wholly taken by age. A man made this garden for me, whether I liked it or not. After I had gone, he let it go wild to armoured holly and hawthorn, the small beer of thugweeds. But in time, it will settle, a wiry daisy meadow, well fenced.
That was Judy Brown in conversation with Julia Kopus. You can find out more about Judy on her website at www.judy-brown.co.uk. And that concludes episode 193, which was recorded and produced by Julia Kopus. Coming up in episode 194, in Writing versus Life, On Balance, we talk to a number of RLF writers about the challenges of balancing writing against other aspects of their lives, how to stay grounded, and whether it's okay for artists to be selfish. We hope you'll join us. You've been listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. To subscribe to podcasts and to find out more about the work of the RLF, please visit our website at www.rlf.org.uk. Thanks for listening.